of Frontex, Caroline Casey. So today, this week, we will be honoring really Venus, the art of peace in myriad forms. We're going to have our great ally, briefly, Celia Alario, great KPF ally and former host, now based in Moab, Utah, and an ally of Tim DeChristopher's, the great artful activist who stepped up and bid on the oil and gas leases and derailed some of the looting of nature. And now Celia will be guiding us into Power Shift, which is happening this weekend. And right after that, we will set sail with inviting Venus Art, Beauty, and Intimacy back from her exile to be honored as a leading evolutionary ally with our great guest, Dennis Dutton, joining us from New Zealand. But first, Celia, are you there?
I sure am. Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. So we will be basing next week's show on all the great things that you are in the midst of. But why don't you just tell our team what's brewing in Washington, D.C. right now?
Ooh, well, you can feel it in the air. It's absolutely electrifying. But they are starting to trickle in. There are 10,000 young climate leaders and tricksters and change makers who are coming to converge on D.C. And they are coming with a really bold message to challenge new President Obama, and of course to challenge Congress to really make some serious changes and actions around climate, the economy, energy, and the environment. And they're going to be in a summit for the whole weekend, and then on Monday, amazing things will happen. About 5,000 of them will be lobbying. We think this is actually, Caroline, going to be the largest lobby day in history on any topic. 350 or more meetings, and about a quarter of the members are brave enough to actually take these meetings directly with these students. The rest will be meetings with staff. And then, of course, as you also know, in a separate but also amazing and stunning event on Monday, they expect 2,000 to 5,000 young people will also gather at the Capitol coal plant, which, of course, heats and cools the actual chambers of Congress, and in a massive act of civil disobedience. All of these things hopefully catalyzing and continuing to fuel a huge shift.
Fabulous. That is really exciting, and I will, of course, thanks to your kind guidance and auspices, be down there covering it for our team, for Coyote Network News and Pacifica Radio and our show. So I will see you this weekend.
Yeah, and the one thing I want to make sure that your listeners know is if they want to be with us in spirit, there's a couple of ways to do that. For people who are into Twitter, they can follow us on Twitter, and that would be PowerShift09. And then also for people who want to experience these powerful plenary sessions on Friday and Saturday night, we're going to stream that live video over the Internet, PowerShift09.org/live. And, yeah, I really want to encourage people to just hold everyone in their thoughts, pray to the deity of your choice for these young people who are really taking on their future here and hopefully going to create clean, green jobs and a brighter future.
Absolutely. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will be offering a keynote address at the culminating rally.
Yes, absolutely. And former Salt Lake Mayor Rocky Anderson
is
addressing folks. Yeah. The other thing that's really exciting is that they actually get to address a special session of a briefing of a special congressional committee on Monday, testifying before it's Ed Markey's committee. It's a special committee on climate change and energy. So there's a tremendous amount of attention and focus on. And the really exciting part for your listeners to wet their whistle for next week is that basically in the absence of leadership from the federal government during the last 8 years, you know, when our administration was not taking action around climate, these young people did on their campuses, in their communities, even at the state level. Laws and policies and projects are in place because of their actions. There are windmills standing. There are coal plants that aren't burning coal anymore. There are green buildings. There are energy efficiency programs. Just absolutely remarkable successes. They've even done things like raise their own student fees so that they could find the funds to then pay for clean energy on their campus. It's
real
remarkable.
Real leadership. Well, absolutely bless you, because we're going to dive in with our guest from New Zealand on the story of how it's going to turn out okay, the art and the crucial quality of the leadership quality of the art of storytelling. So thank you, and we will be in cahoots this weekend, and we will brew a fantastic show for next week out of this. Thank you.
You know it. Have a great one.
Woof, woof. Yes. Great. Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, so there's our great ally, that part of our team that is out there in Washington. So today we are weaving you know, our team in California, with our team in Washington, with our team in New Zealand. And so we say, let imagination lay the tracks for the reality train, which is something I always say. So we do want to invite Venus, Art, Beauty, and Intimacy, back from her exile, where she's been trivialized as kind of like, oh, frou-frou. You know, we remember the very first guest on this show, James Hillman, 12 years ago, who contributed this crucial thought, which is the opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. That either we have a living, dynamic sense of aesthetics, or we're anesthetized and asleep, which means we can't have a democracy. So without beauty, we're going nowhere. So we are inviting Venus back as leading evolutionary ally with author Dennis Dutton, whom I first saw on the Colbert Report, where he was very plucky and playful, and actually really danced with Colbert. He is joining us from New Zealand, where Venus is rising due east right now, with his really useful contribution, beautiful and useful, we'd say, The Art Instinct, a Darwinian honoring of the evolutionary leadership of art. And we say Dennis Dutton is a philosopher, founder, and editor of the highly regarded web publication Arts and Letters, which is www.aldaily.com. Many people find it completely addictive. Wonderful articles like Da Vinci was a procrastinator. Ah, what a relief. He teaches the philosophy of art at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand, writes widely on aesthetics, and is editor of the journal Philosophy and Literature, and the author of the recently published The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. Welcome, Dennis.
Well, Carolyn, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I don't know if I can live up to that intro.
Well, I'm going to give you more to live up to. We were talking backstage, one of my favorite Matthew Arnold quotes. He said, to be cultured is to be acquainted with the highest possibilities of the aesthetic human spirit throughout time. And I think you're doing a good job.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, if you think about all the things that one can imagine living without, living ever without love, without, you know, having pets, without experiencing the beauties of nature, without experiencing the highest aesthetic achievements. I think, you know, we've only got a life here, and we've got to try to find some of the best things in it. That's something that Matthew Arnold really understood.
Yes.
And he thought the humanities was about seeking out the very best achievements that human beings have ever produced, and living with them and trying to understand them. I mean, you know, never to fully master them, because they're always beyond what we can understand. But I think art's important, and I think philosophy's important, and I've tried to combine them.
No, you've done a great job, and even smuggling it into the Colbert Report, where what grabbed my fancy is you were saying eloquence, storytelling, cave paintings, 19th century fiction. And I was like, oh, this is fun. You know, these are evolutionary assists, and so we do want to dive into the art of storytelling.
I must say that that Stephen Colbert had fun with me on that. He said, oh, you're saying that the cavemen were there sitting there reading Jane Austen in their caves.
Exactly.
Mr. Imagination.
Yes, but you spiraled and danced. And let me bring up also one of the qualities in, you know, many art forms is the ritual theatrical circle, like in capoeira in Brazil. There's a circle in which, you know, community conflicts are resolved within that theatrical border. You invite in, it's sort of like you and Colbert dancing, you know, come in and you play and you trick. You never take your eyes off of your, you know, kind of ally opponent, but that's where things are resolved. So I want to just sort of put before you this idea that, that, you know, the theme of create theater or live melodrama, that theater has a possibly, let me pitch it to you, has an evolutionary assist because communities can resolve conflicts without having war.
Absolutely. What it comes down to, I think, is fundamentally imagination. We're a species that can imaginatively not simply think about what might be on the other side of a hill or up in a tree someplace. We can think about the past, far into the deep past of our lives and that of our fellows. We can think into the future, but we can think in terms, as you put it, of stories, of narratives, and we can think of whole different ways that life might be constructed, or we might plan this, or we might strategize that. And that ability to think imaginatively, of course it can be bad in the sense that we might strategize a war on a neighboring tribe or on another culture or another country. It can be good because we can strategize also ways of reducing conflict or of solving problems. We are a problem-solving species. Alas, we're a problem-making species too, let's face it. But human imagination, which is intrinsic to the arts, is intrinsic to the human mind and all of human life.
And can I just put on our work table here that I think that war is a failure of imagination?
Yes, I think it is. I can't say that all bloody conflict is a failure of imagination. If your life is on the line, you couldn't exactly oppose the Wehrmacht going into Poland by standing down and having peace signs. Peace is not always the answer to survival or the answer to culture. Sometimes war is. But it is a failure on somebody's part. It has to be, because it's so horrible.
Right. And we could tussle with that one, too. And just for the fun of it, you know, I do have the astronomical chart of right now, where Venus is rising in the east, where you are 18 hours in the future in New Zealand.
Yes.
And when your ally, being a voice for Charles Darwin, was born, Venus was in Aries, right where it is now, really within a couple degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And just for the fun of it, Venus represents art, Aries is leadership. It's in Darwin's chart, it's in the chart of right now, and here we are aligning with that possibility.
That's quite interesting, and the reason, of course, I can listen to what you're saying and understand exactly what you're saying, and I'm sitting here in the studio, I know where due north is and due south, and I know where the sun would be, I also know where Venus would be rising, is because I'm an amateur astronomer.
Oh, fabulous.
And I became an amateur astronomer as an adolescent. I think I started it probably around 12 years old, and have had telescopes most of my life, very large telescopes here in the southern hemisphere, up to a 12.5-inch Newtonian reflector. So I know about astronomy. I'm, of course, as you can imagine, being an astronomer, I'm not all that keen on every aspect of astrology, particularly the predictive aspects of astrology. On the other hand, astrology, if I'm going to be, I want to be the generous guest to my host here, I'm not going to be somebody from the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal.
I've talked with them before.
I know. I happen to be the founder of that organization.
Oh, that's a hoot. That's wonderful.
Here in New Zealand,
right.
I'm
uh-huh.
kind of known in this country as Mr. Skeptic.
Great. No, I love that.
Yeah, well, I also understand a point of view. And I always felt when I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Barbara in California that part of the popularity of astrology was the failure of psychology. That at least in astrological charts, you seem to meet real people that you know. In psychology texts, you just meet sort of overblown humanoid rats that run mazes. And there is something to be said for astrology. At least it does seem to deal with the kind of human types that we're familiar with.
Well,
in that sense, it's more like fictional narrative, and it's more like storytelling.
It is indeed storytelling, and when I've addressed in the media, you know, kind of a grumpy scientist unlike yourself, I've said, you know, what if we say that astrology is a language of poetic intimacy, you know, rather than a science? Then, like, oh well, then that's okay.
I quite agree with that.
There's a wonder-
and I know you're also opposed to because I mean, having listened to your interview on the Washington Post with Sally Quinn, it was very interesting. Opposed to a dependency on astrologers.
Or anybody.
And you're opposed to priesthoods.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, dependency on astrology is a feature of the modern world, even if your clients aren't dependent on you. And astrology is associated historically with priesthoods. For a long time.
But for both of us, we want to go way back in order to go way forward. So we'll do that. Then the last little bit, I'll just put for the fun of it, the poetry of it. There are images associated with each degree of the zodiac. So where Venus, art, in Aries leadership is right now, its image is Indian woman weaving a magical basket out of serpents, interweaving conflicting desires and opinions within the conversation so they can work towards a single goal. So, isn't that fun?
That sounds good.
That's what we're doing.
I'll go for that.
All right, let's weave a let's weave a basket of serpents. Absolutely.
Well, I hope they're benign serpents, for God's sake.
Yes. Well, they used to be thought of as so. I mean, we do want to go way back. I mean, so I was extremely engaged, and I want you to give full voice to Darwin, because he does get misinterpreted and get a bad rap and is often as dismissed as art is in many ways. So maybe you can be his voice, or what you think he has to contribute now, because your book, The Art Instinct, is saying, you know, the art is an evolutionary assist.
Yes, art. I regard art as an adaptation, maybe not one adaptation, like a liking for sweet or a liking for sexual pleasure, but certainly a concatenation, an ensemble of adaptations which come together, which give us the great artistic traditions that we have in the world. And of course, I'm as interested in tribal arts and in indigenous arts as I am in the late quartets of Beethoven and the Goldberg variations and the plays of Shakespeare. I mean, this is all art, and I would want to take a very broad view of it. I mean, I think there are three elements that we've got to bear in mind here. One is that across cultures, everywhere, the arts provide pleasure. They give us intense pleasure, some of the times the most intense pleasures of our life. Whenever you have a pleasure of any kind, whether it's a pleasure of a food or it's a pleasure of some kind of amusement or puzzle solving or whatever it is, that's usually an indication of the play of some kind of an evolutionary adaptation. The arts are universal. There is no known culture that does not have some kind of art. You don't have every art in every culture. We don't have anything in the West quite like the Japanese tea ceremony and, Nilotic cattle herders. Some of those tribes don't have anything like visual art, but they're terrific in poetry. So the arts vary from culture to culture in what's emphasized, but there are no arts without culture.
And as your friend Steven Pinker says, again, a great intro we might read after the break of you, but, you know, as universal as language.
Yes. And as spontaneous as language, and that exactly is the third thing, that the arts arise spontaneously. I mean, almost every time when human beings have any kind of an activity that they can begin to take a disinterested view of, they'll turn it into a competition, and they'll turn it into an expressive art. Children, just simply in playing, watch a small child play. Watch a tea party with a kid, and you're sitting around with the dollies and the teddy bears and pouring tea, and of course there's no tea in the teapot and the cups are empty, but then a full cup gets turned over and, oh my gosh, you apologize and isn't that terrible, and turn the cup back. The child will know exactly how to pour the tea, hold the spout over the pot, over the cup, and pour from the pot, won't make any mistakes about which was the empty and which was the full cup. We'll go from that complicated game to watching a cartoon on television. We'll go from there to reading a book, to having mommy or daddy tell a story, then go into the real world and have dinner with mommy and daddy, and keep all of the... We're talking about three-year-olds here who can keep completely separate, logically different worlds with their own rules and their own realities, and not confuse them. The fact that very small children can have that kind of play and can do it spontaneously is a mark of a Darwinian adaptation. It happened in the Pleistocene. It happened in that 1.6 million years back, up to about 10,000 years ago when agriculture and cities were invented. But it's that period before there where we became human. If you go back to the beginning of the Pleistocene and you found your ancestors, if you saw them walking down the street today, you'd call the zoo and, you know, you'd try to get the SPCA out.
No, not us.
We say that just isn't us.
But no. But I mean, you and I wouldn't call the zoo.
We might, because they might run into the traffic and they might not understand.
Right.
You know,
yes,
I mean, you'd want to maybe catch them, not because they're a threat, because they'd be threatened by taxis and whatnot going down the street. You'd want to save them, because you'd regard them as animals that are in need of protection. At the end of the Pleistocene, at the end of that 1.6 million years, in which there, incidentally, there are 80,000 thousand generations.
Yeah,
that's
I love that.
An unimaginably long time. At the end of that, if you saw them on the street, well, they'd be just like you and me, you know. You'd maybe call the Immigration and Naturalization Service, but
no,
that's
no.
about as, well, maybe not even
no, no,
do
no.
that.
No, no, we're not, we want things to run free. No, we're not imprisoning.
I must say I do, too.
No, so, free range as much as possible.
They'd be free range human beings. But I think the Darwinian is really interested in how the human personality, the things that make us interested in the world, the things that make us charming to each other, our wit, our humor, our expressiveness, our lovely ability to express ourselves objectively in ways that other human beings can understand and can appreciate, our appreciation for skills, our liking simply for representations, for pictures of things, our love of music, that all emerged in that period of the Pleistocene, probably to a large degree in the last 100,000 years of it. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about an art instinct. We're talking about something which is basically hardwired into the human character. We can't help it. We can't help being involved with it. We can't help in loving the arts. Of course, we love different arts. We have different tastes. These abilities are heritable, that meaning that they vary in populations. Our tastes for various kinds of things vary. But, of course, Darwinism depends on mutations and variations. If there weren't variations, there couldn't be evolutionary progress.
And
we're a part of this entire varied and yet oriented towards survival and reproduction world that is our prehistory.
Now in the language, the artful language of astrology, Venus is art and intimacy. So it says to us that the artist is the person most intimate with the environment, not the alienated, you know, recently fashioned. But I love, even on your book jacket and the first couple chapters in which you say, our love of beauty is inborn, and such as the preference for landscapes that feature water and distant trees, like the savanna where we first evolved. Now, teasing this kind of into, you know, where we can feel it as practical, too, I love that, because you're implying that we're all kind of, we hold in our hearts this kind of yearning for the African homeland, the savanna, the water, the greens.
Yes, it's not necessarily African, because, of course, we left Africa a long time ago, so we acquired tastes for many kinds of landscapes. But this goes back to something that really was an experiment done back in the early 1990s when the artists Komar and Melamed got the idea that they wanted to do a poll, and they got the Nation Foundation, publishers of the Nation magazine, to fund a poll in 10 different countries. It ended up actually with more than 10, but the original poll was for 10 countries, to find out what people's favorite paintings were, what their favorite work of art is, what the size was, what the favorite color was, what the actual content of the painting was, or if they preferred abstraction and so forth. And overwhelmingly, across the world, Komar and Melamed were very surprised to find out that there actually was something that stood out, just like a big spike up there, that people wanted. They wanted landscapes. Not only that, they wanted landscapes that actually looked more like each other than they looked like the landscapes that were available for appreciation in some of the home countries. They wanted basically a kind of Hudson River landscape with water, with copses of trees and open areas, with an opening up in at least one direction to an unimpeded view on the horizon. They liked animal life and they liked bird life. They wanted a diversity of greenery. And, of course, they wanted other things. They liked historical figures. They liked wild animals, domestic animals. They liked children. Komar and Melamed themselves painted then for every country its most wanted paintings, and they do resemble each other as landscapes, although they also, their jokesterism came out when they, tricksters is what they are, because in the America's Most Wanted, for example, they had this beautiful Hudson River landscape. They also had some children in it who looked like they were out of Disneyland. George Washington standing in a clearing there in the center of the picture, and behind him a hippopotamus bellowing in the river.
Yes.
So, of course, it was all a big joke to them. But nevertheless, there was a serious underlying discovery here. And it turns out there's a good psychological literature on this. The Germans have done a lot of research on this, and other people have, showing that there are innate landscape preferences.
And colors. Blue.
And colors, blue. Yeah. I mean, and your guess would be as good as mine as to why blue is the favorite color across the earth, but it is. That's the color people prefer.
And let me just underline for, our council, our work table, you know, what leads us into kinship with our allies, the 10,000 youth part of ourselves gathering in Washington, is that, you know, we do all, I think, as your book and your work suggests, carry within us, you know, the desirable image of water and green and wild animals and pastoral setting, and that's what we want to preserve, protect. You know, that,
yes,
it lives in each one of us.
And of course, what was such a problem for some theorists who'd looked at this, Arthur Danto, for example, who'd written about it, was the fact that if you take the view that all of our aesthetic tastes are socially constructed, that they come from our culture, this, by the way, is the great opposite idea of my book. It's the idea that I'm opposing through the whole book, and it's the idea that is taught in seminars there in Berkeley. It's taught in universities all over the world. It is sort of the presupposition. The default position is all of our aesthetic tastes are cultural tastes. I'm saying no. Some of our aesthetic tastes are based in genetics. That doesn't mean that the English language isn't a cultural expression, and Shakespeare's plays are written in English. Therefore, of course, Shakespeare's plays are, to a large extent, cultural. They're Elizabethan. But they're also deeply human, and they're based in human genetics, just as our landscape preferences are based in genetics, which is why you find, incidentally, the same landscape preferences and the same preferences for Shakespeare plays and their plots in China as you do in this country.
Yes, when we come, we're not quite at break, but we're almost at break. But when we come back from break, I want to go into the seven forms, actually nine forms of storytelling, which is great, and the mystery of fiction. Because, you know, because in your book, which is just really useful, and it's also really useful to go from me, going animals and art, we want to bring that back up, because we know that whales have, you know, songs that evolve, and as the noise in the ocean has gotten louder, their musical quality has devolved. So, you know, under that. But I don't know. I certainly don't know. I don't know of any animals myself who have fiction. So we want to come back to stories and fiction, although I'm open to mystery and wonder. So we want to kind of honor that. But, yeah, some of my great environmental lawyer and scientist allies say that they feel that beauty is an instinct, pattern, symmetry. You know, again, not man-made glamour, but again, that sense of beauty and symmetry and therefore health and well-being, and that's part of what you're expressing, yeah?
I think so. I won't say that it's all necessarily natural. I mean, I think that there's a kind of a return to nature romanticism among many Greens. I think New York City is sublimely beautiful. I think the great cities of the world are wonderful. They're great expressions of the human spirit. On the other hand, I was driving between Santa Barbara and Palo Alto on a recent book tour that I took of the U.S., and was looking north of Santa Barbara up some of those valleys, and just they're heartbreakingly, sublimely beautiful to see those live oaks, to see those open areas and streams coming down, going into those California hills and up into higher mountains. So I don't think beauty's any one thing. I think the beauty of your own baby, the beauty of a well-cooked meal, the beauty of a great story, the beauty of a landscape, the beauty of a Picasso painting, the beauty of a city, the beauty of the country. I think these are all beauties, and they're all part of our Darwinian heritage, and it's making sense of that in general with a theory that works. You know, what did you say to Sally Quinn? You said, you said, well, talking about astrology, a friend of yours had remarked, sure, it works in practice, but does it work in theory?
Exactly.
And now that's interesting. I'd like to just analyze that for a second. Maybe
we're going to take a break and
come back to that one.
We're going to take a very short break. Our guest today is the lively embodiment of culture, Dennis Dutton. He is joining us from New Zealand, and I think we're just going to keep going. If you're really, really patient, you can wait for a call, and I'll put out the number later, but I think we're going to keep rolling, and we'll be right back after a very short break.
shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his causes cry. Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our guest today is Dennis Dutton, philosopher, founder, and editor of the web publication Arts and Letters Daily, which many find completely addictive in a good way, which is aldaily.com, teacher of philosophy, and we are exploring his contribution as embodied in his book, The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. So here we are diving back in, Dennis. Dennis, of course, means, what, it's Dionysus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Dionysus, yes, exactly.
Right, so of course you enjoy pleasure.
I enjoy pleasure, I enjoy wine.
Yes, excellent. That's right, cause also, you know, 2,500 years ago, the fantastic, poetry to Inanna, you know, in which Inanna, after she gets back from the underworld, she decides to steal human culture back, and she sails to Enki's island. The tyrant king has kidnapped culture known as Mies, M-E-apostrophe-S, and she gets him drunk. And as he's drunk, he says, all right, I give back to you the art of storytelling. And she goes, I take that. I give back to you the art of painting. I take that. I give back to you the art of, you know, the erotic arts of amusing the vulva and of, you know, adoring the phallus. And she goes, I take that. It goes on. But what's very witty, and your book does address this too, is that in that myth, the erotic arts are considered equal to, like, writing.
Hmm, that's interesting. Yes, I'm a little doubtful of that, because I think the erotic arts are kind of universal. I mean, one has to say there's an art of cooking and there's an art of eating. But on the other hand, there just is food and there's eating, too, for hunger. Eroticism can also be a high art, there's no doubt about it, and could be practiced as an art. But on the other hand, it can be practiced and feel pretty good when it's not done as an art, but it's simply done as lovemaking without an artistic or expressive component very much.
No, that's true. You can eat over the sink. You know,
yeah, you
true.
Can eat over the sink, and you know, whatever else you can do over the sink too. We won't. We don't need to describe it. Whereas I think with the arts, we are looking for something more than just the erotic arts. I actually say something about that in the last chapter of the book.
Yes.
Why, for example, do you not have direct sex acts in most works of art, even in cultures where it could be allowed? For example, erotic traditions in Japanese art. The highest Japanese art actually doesn't have sex that goes on directly, either on stage or anyplace else. And people say, oh, well, this is just a religious repression or whatnot. If we didn't have that, there'd be people would be naked and, you know, running around in works of art and whatnot. I'm not so sure about it. I somehow think that there's something innate in a sense maybe it sounds puritanical to say it. I don't mean it that way. It's a sheer empirical hypothesis. But there's something innate in a sense of decorum about where sex stands in life. And love relations, of course, we write about that. But in European dramatic traditions, sex is something that takes place off stage, either to make more comic predicaments in comedies, or as something that involves a sense of tragedy, where love and sex ultimately yield to death.
I got to bring up just the exception, which is in Persian and Hindu miniatures, extremely explicit in Hindu temple art, extremely explicit and witty erotic art.
Yes, I think that's right, and I accept that. I also would accept it with the Japanese erotic traditions.
Yeah.
Would you say, though, let me just ask you this, Caroline, would you say that that the fact that those arts, for example, Kujaraho, in India are not considered among the great canonical works of the human tradition. Do you think that's just prudery? Or do you think they are? I mean, I think there's something rather mechanical about Khajuraho.
I'm seeing in my mind's eye right now some extremely explicit, very witty Hindu miniatures, in which there is explicit art, but it's also clearly high culture. There's, you know, kind of food, and there's art around the couple, and there's, you know, wit and humor and interplay and exquisite talent. So, no, I'm just putting that on the table going, no,
yeah,
I think these are mysteries rather than certainties.
Yeah, they sure are. My book does not have all the answers.
And it's more, I think it's more maybe the manner of rather than, you know, the freedom is in the manner of rather than even the subject. So,
yes.
And the originating intent. And that's why I want to also just sort of open the door for you to explore what's so useful, the power of story. You quote your colleague and also friend of the show, E.O. Wilson, "Art fills imaginative gap in times of rapid evolution." Very intriguing and
yes,
useful.
That's an intriguing remark. I do quote it, but that doesn't mean that I'm sure I exactly understand it.
No, but I like it.
Yes, it does seem to me to make sense.
Well, I want to go to the art of story, because right after that you talk about in novels, say Esther Summerson, the protagonist of great Dickens storytelling, Bleak House, she survives by creating an imaginative world to escape from degrading limitation. And in the story, like I think in life, it does then open the door for her.
That's right.
It's like the Arabian Nights are full of that, which is that you tell the story and that conjures the reality.
Yes, it conjures the reality. It enriches your mind. It broadens your horizons. I mean, I think that we are fundamentally a curious species. We're a traveling species. We're an investigating species where we can be. We love to interact with other human beings, and we can do this imaginatively with all sorts of people we could never meet in real life with stories. So stories are enormously enriching. If you're going to be a proper Darwinian, though, you need stronger criteria than just enriching. You have to somehow be able to argue that the storytelling instinct, if that's what it is, actually had survival value in the Pleistocene.
Well,
now, I think it did.
Yeah.
And I think it did on two counts. One is storytelling was important to us because it actually allowed us to invent and understand narratives of possible actions, future actions for ourselves. It allowed us to get information about the world. Much better to hear stories about lions than to go out in the wild and experiment with lions on your own. That's rather dangerous. That's a high-cost sort of experimentation. But the other side of storytelling is that storytelling is also an expression of the storyteller. And that's the other half of storytelling. We love wit. We love eloquence. Eloquence, by the way, is a human universal. The admiration of eloquence is in every known culture. That seems to be some kind of an adaptation. Doesn't have to be that way.
And how do you imagine it as an evolutionary assist?
Well, I think it's an evolutionary assist because it's a fundamentally it's a signal indication of intelligence. The ability to speak well is an important way that you can judge a person. I mean, whether we think that we're doing it or try to imagine we're not doing it, all the time we're judging people about how they speak. When they can't get their verbs in agreements with their nouns, when they can't make proper plurals, when they can't distinguish their criteria from their criterion, if you know that distinction. Of course, if you don't know that distinction, it won't make any sense to you. But as we move up in our knowledge of language, we're constantly judging people on their use of language. Now, some people will say, oh, that's just all social. My book argues it's not social. My book argues that is a Pleistocene adaptation, that we actually are making judgments about people's competence and their intelligence by their use of language, which is one of the reasons why we have such massive vocabularies. The average listener to this program would have a vocabulary of approximately 80 to 120,000 words.
And growing. Which,
and growing daily.
That's right.
Growing daily by listening to programs like this. And these are based on maybe 15 to 20,000 word families, because that includes all of the plural forms. To do that, you have to learn something like 15 words a day every day of your life between the ages of 4 and 18.
Ooh, let's do it. Let's keep it going, though.
Yeah, and that's not explained by natural selection, because that's not required to survive in the Pleistocene. That's explained by sexual selection, the peacock's tail. That's explained by the fact that people in the Pleistocene were more attracted to articulate people than they were to inarticulate people.
But how do we know that? I mean, I like that idea, but how do we know that?
We don't know it. We have to reconstruct based on how we understand sexual selection, based on the ways in which language is a marker for health or for intelligence. We can reverse engineer our present tastes in terms of what we know about evolution. That's the best we can do, because we can't go back and interview people. On the other hand, I think you can make a pretty strong case that much of what is over the top, indeed wasteful, extravagant, opulent, expensive, this use of synonyms in words, our joke telling, the way in which we interact and quite try to show off with each other, that this is worked in. This is a permanent feature of the human personality. It's not cultural. It's absolutely pleasure giving and across all known cultures. That these aspects also work into the arts and explain why we have these great museums, why people pay millions of dollars for sharks pickled in formaldehyde, for Leonardo da Vinci paintings, for all of the things that we so much enjoy.
Wait, what's the shark thing?
Oh, the shark is, Damien Hirst's shark in formaldehyde I was referring to.
Ah, I don't know that.
Oh, yeah, well, anyway.
So that's art, okay.
Well, sure, that's art, and at least it's certainly in art museums, and he's selling them for however much he's selling, over $1 million each or something. I've forgotten what the latest figures are on Damien Hirst's experiments.
Well,
But, I mean, a lot of things that people think are kind of outrageous about the arts, I think are built into the very idea of the arts. The arts are opulent, over the top, and indeed rather unnatural by some standards.
Well,
but that's part of the reason we have them.
But let's think of storytelling, and I'd love you to, we can go Overcoming the Monster and Rags to Riches and Quest, mm-hmm, and Voyage and Return, and then detective novels. I mean, I love your embrace of pop culture. I'm crazy about detective novels, because I think it's a deep immersion in the underworld and then a restoration of balance.
Oh, yes.
I love them. But also, stories do pass on knowledge.
They do. I mean, there are views that the many passages in Homer, for example,
right,
were for the pre-literate Greeks ways of understanding human relations, how you address people of a certain status, how a ship is rigged or how cargo is brought ashore. That there's lots of things that you have already in Homer
and
Hesiod and elsewhere that's actually didactic.
Well,
we don't see it as didactic today, but the Greeks did.
Well, we do, actually. I mean, I've had a number of guests on this show who are working with war trauma, and they say the Odyssey is the manual for how you take vets home.
You know, very interesting.
Go, oh,
yes.
And then I just wanted to bring up William Irwin Thompson has a great essay on Rapunzel, and it's just brilliant, and I think most of it actually is legitimate. And he says the story, you know, the plant Rapunzel actually is the story, and he teases from that story the entire history of biology and sex on this planet and the orbit of the Sun, Moon, and Mars, and many other things too. But just as a little brief thing, we remember Rapunzel, lets down her hair. He said when he was researching Rapunzel, the plant, he thought it would be good for women and, you know, who are pregnant and stuff, because that's a theme. But he found out that the plant was the story. It grows up like a tower, and the plant sends out two golden braids to attract pollination.
Really?
Yes. And he said because it's one of those transitional plants, it can self-pollinate, but it would prefer to have sex.
My goodness.
Isn't that fabulous? It is.
That's
a fabulous
story.
So again,
but however, I that does bring me back to something I did want to say earlier. And that was the remark that you made to Sally Quinn. Sure, it works in practice, but does it work in theory? And of course, in a way, you can that can be a sort of a joke remark that defends something like astrology, which does work in practice. So what do you care about the theory? I think we do need a theory. I think that that what we've had is, for example, with literary theory taught at Berkeley and a lot of other places for the last 40 years, particularly the last 20 years, with literary theory, we've had horrible, execrable, deadening, oppressive theories which have actually distanced us from the joy of stories and literature and language.
Yeah, I suffered through semiotics.
At Brown University, gets worse.
Exactly.
So theory can be bad. On the other hand, if I look at someone like Jung, who seems to me to be a genius, seems to me to be prescient, seems to me to have intuitions that are great intuitions. What Jung didn't have is a theory. Why would we, like a mandala? Or why do we like these things?
Oh, he does.
Darwin actually has an empirical theory that works, that has real sort of empirical applications, experimental potential. An example of this practice versus theory thing is, let's say, when it became finally fashionable in the 19th century for before they delivered babies. And you can say, well, it worked in practice, so why do you need the germ theory of disease? If it works in practice, that's fine. You've got the germ theory of disease. By the way, that's the reason you wash hands. Once you've got the germ theory of disease, then you can go on and apply it rationally elsewhere in the future.
Oh.
And that's what I think Darwinian aesthetics does. It has a theory that actually, for once, makes sense, doesn't degrade or reduce, but actually brings forward and I think glorifies the arts.
Well,
and the human spirit.
Right, okay, I will resist the impulse to go backwards because there's so much in what you said, but it's like forward. So the theory is, again, Darwin's theory, the ability to imagine scenarios not present, adaptive power of storytelling. Is that also...
And the pleasure, the simple pleasure that is in admiring a storyteller. To admire not only the story, but to admire the telling of it. The wit and the eloquence of the telling is so compelling to us. We love stories and we love storytellers.
Yes, and these are also great mysteries, the power of story, and as you say, pretty much universal storytelling, and the love of fiction. And that is where I can go, animals have songs, animals I think have, I've seen coyote art, I'm going to go for it, making designs and, and we also, there's a sentimental, we want the elephants to be painting, we don't know if they are, but where you branch out and go, humans and fiction, I go, oh, yeah, that might be unique. As you quote Aristotle, you go, spectacle is the most superficial and least interesting aspect, that, again, modern culture's gotten a little addicted to the spectacle, but the story structure is crucial.
Well, that does seem to be unique, but let me play your advocate here for a second. Think about animals at play. Think about puppies playing. Think about how one will stalk the other.
Right, that's fiction.
As though it's a narrative and a story. You're my prey. I'm going to pretend I'm going to get you. And then jump. The kitten jumps on the other kitten, or the puppy on the puppy.
Yes.
And then pretends to kill it. Seems to me that you already have even the beginnings of narrative there in animal play.
Right. So it is not exclusively human. You're coming over to the animals as are more equal than we think.
Yeah, I think that. I do, of course, in the introduction, have some critical things to say about chimpanzee art.
Right.
Because the chimpanzees, of course, are our closest living relatives. People do go into primate centers and zoos and give chimpanzees paintbrushes and big bits of butcher paper, and they love actually to disrupt the paper by putting these big color blobs on them. But of course, what you never hear in these stories are the following considerations. One, the only reason that you have that chimpanzee art and you can enjoy it is that the trainer had to remove the paper from the chimp, because the chimp has no plan and doesn't know when to stop. So the chimp can make some interesting things, and then the trainer removes the paper. But if the trainer doesn't remove the paper, it's nothing but a brown blob that's left.
Well,
the chimp just won't stop.
Like many second graders.
Yes, yes. Many second graders would be exactly the same thing.
So we'd say they're doing art, but they need the training.
Well, is the second grader doing art, or is the second grader doing what the chimp is doing, putting big colored blobs with finger painting or with brushes onto paper and getting the pleasure from that? I would say if the second grader has no sense even of when to stop, that counts against the idea that this is, technically speaking, art. The other thing, of course, is that the chimps, not only do they not know when to stop, once they actually have gone away from that piece of paper, they never come back to look at it again or to admire it. Now,
well,
that does seem to me to be a pretty big impediment of saying, chimps have art.
Tibetan Buddhists make sand paintings and never look back. Pour it all back into the river. I don't know that you have to go back and go, oh, God, that's
Yeah, but there's
so fantastic.
A culture there. There's a culture. God. They've learned that culture. They've learned those paintings. The chimps never talk about painting with each other. They never learn from the examples of each other. Well, so far as we know. I think we know a lot about chimps. I don't think they're an unknown species. They're not discussing painting with each other. Human art comes from a culture. Of course, there's a genetic basis for it, and that's what my book is about. It stresses that. But, of course, all of this is cultural at the same time. It's part of human art traditions. We are genetically determined to be cultural beasts. And I think that's where art stands. I think that we're romantically kidding ourselves by watching those chimps and saying, yeah, they make art like we do.
Yeah, no, I'm in favor of that. I'm going, go, Dennis, take it down.
Of course, I love animals. You know, we've talked about this before. That I am an animal lover and an admirer of animals. But I want to treat them as what they are, and not as sort of proto-human beings necessarily.
No, I love that. I mean, and I love that. You know, to love animals means we avoid sentimentalizing, but we do approach with wonder and curiosity. So I'm happy to have you take the chimp thing down. That's not art, and that's imposing.
Caroline, I want to ask you a question. Do you know anything about these YouTube videos that are there on the net of these of the Thailand elephants who are doing the painting?
Yes, I've seen those.
I mean, are they? I've noticed that in all of them, there's always a trainer at the side of the elephant.
Yeah.
And the trainer's always on the other side of the camera, kind of hidden, but you can see the guy's feet or some little... it's clear there's a trainer there.
Yeah,
how are they doing this?
I don't know. And that's what I meant. We were referring to it several miles back, in which I go, we want them to be doing that. We really...
Yes.
Because there is that, when it goes, and it is making this fantastic painting of an elephant in a very...
The control of the brush is astonishing.
So I leave that to a mystery. I mean, we want it to be true, but we go, why aren't we seeing, the whole elephant? What is the trainer doing there? We don't know. But I think what's important to note is it is extraordinary. We don't know what, but what it elicits in our heart is we want that to be true.
Yeah, we do.
We do.
Yeah
we really
but
do.
When I was a little kid, I wanted to believe that the birds were talking to each other.
They are.
I talked to my mommy.
Well, the crows...
Not quite the same.
No, but we know that crows pass on language. I mean, we know that we do that. I'm rooting for, the 19th century poem, if humans had black feathers and could fly, few would be smart enough to be crows. I'm rooting over there too.
I've been corresponding with a man named David Rothenberg in New York recently. He's written a book on birds. Song.
Oh, great.
And
because it does change.
He thinks that bird song really has to be seen as a kind of animal art, an expressive art.
And mouse courtship songs.
Yeah.
In laboratories, prison. They have Mozart-like arias. They're well above human hearing, but they're out on YouTube. And even in lab prisons, the mouse will be improvising and sending a little song that changes every day, like "Hello, I'm a cute guy," come on. But it's true. We don't want to impose, but we do want to wonder, going, "Whoa," And again, the purpose of art, I'm going to say for the fun of it, is enhanced kinship, and exploring and wondering. So we do want to go, "Oh, it maybe doesn't separate us."
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for advancing kinship or social solidarity or social bonds, but there's also an element in the art which does, of course, this is part of the thesis of the book, is that the arts are also based on sexual selection. They arise out of the world of charm and seduction, of women charming and seducing men and the other way around.
Really?
Skill displays.
All of it.
Not all of it, but I mean
the bard.
Part of it. I mean, I think natural selection, as you've described the storytelling, is very important, but also sexual selection. That is to say, the notion in which we make works of art because to captivate the interests of other human beings.
So as you say, come to my studio and see my etchings.
Would you like to come up and see my etchings? Of course, is the classic line, and that actually can go against social solidarity. I mean, I can only say thank God that the arts are not in favor of social solidarity. Would you like to see artists supporting every administration in Washington year in and year out?
Soviet art, yes. We've seen
Soviet art.
And we have to put the art in quotes, yeah. Exactly.
That's right. Komar and Melamed, to whom I referred earlier, were great critics of the Soviet system. So, I mean, the artists are sometimes in favor of social solidarity, and the arts are sometimes dead set against it and in favor of the individual against society. And I think that's hugely important, and thank God for it.
Or the individual, against the conformity and imprisoning of the group in order to later contribute to the group.
That doesn't necessarily mean it's George Bush and Dick Cheney and the Republicans. It can be the Green Movement that you're against. It can be the conformity of all of your colleagues or your fellow students going out 10,000 in some place and demonstrating. Maybe you don't like any kind of lockstep. I've got to follow the group.
Well, that would
and
be,
you might be an artist who is an individual and just simply feels that way. You might create great art.
Yeah, but that's where we get to the wonderful trickster who again breaks the rules in order to demonstrate to others that they've done it and survived, and with wit and eloquence and elan. I mean, that is part of the trickster dynamic. And it does in some sense then contribute back. How much stability and how much eccentric improv, is always a fluctuating dynamic. In any social dynamic, or evolution. And I say, there's stability and then there's the experimental leap, right?
Exactly. And I'm with you on that. I mean, I'm a great admirer of Odysseus.
Yeah. Okay.
My hero.
Right. He
survived and he got home too.
That's right. Well, okay. In our all too rapidly, waning. But can we go through the seven basic plots or just the why
sure,
you think those
sure.
are useful?
Sure. This is Christopher Booker's work, and he's based it on George Pulte and other people before him. Goethe was interested in it.
Oh, we're just a short minute, so we just have to say
overcoming the monster, rags to riches, quest. It's all in the sixth chapter of The Art Instinct, published by Bloomsbury.
Oh, this is all too short a date, Dennis. This has been really fun, and thank you so much. Our great guest is Dennis Dutton. He's joining us from New Zealand, and his book, The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution, is a lively contributing romp to our essential discourse. So thank you very much, and I hope we do more later.
Thank you, Caroline.
A pleasure. This is Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com, and we will be covering powershift.org next week, and we will reconvene. Thanks to Andrew Chadwick here in D.C. and the KPFA crew, and woof, woof, woof.